Picture this. You're walking past the break room and you catch the tail end of a hushed conversation.
Oh, yeah, the classic office whisper network.
Exactly. Or maybe you're sitting at your desk and a random Slack notification pops up from a coworker. It is the classic office rumor. Someone is, quote, sleeping with the boss.
Right, a phrase we've all heard a million times.
Yeah. And usually it's treated as pure gossip, just a juicy little scandal about who is secretly hooking up after hours, whispered about over your morning coffee.
And it immediately turns into a conversation about private morality. You know, people start analyzing who initiated it or whether they are really in love or where they went for drinks.
Totally.
But in doing that, we completely lose sight of the actual environment they are operating in. We forget the actual architecture of the workplace itself.
Well, today we are tossing that water cooler gossip straight into the trash. Our mission for this deep dive is to completely reframe how you view these workplace relationships.
It is such a needed shift in perspective.
It really is. We are drawing from an incredibly comprehensive legal and institutional analysis by Eric Sanders from the Sanders Firm, PC. And the goal today is to deeply understand exactly why professional boundaries aren't just annoying HR red tape.
Right, they are so much more than that.
Yeah, they are absolutely vital to the survival, the trust, and the very functioning of any organization, whether you are an entry-level employee just starting out, a mid-level manager, or, a CEO overseeing 1,000 people.
Because understanding the true nature of organizational power changes how you view your entire career.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the way we even talk about this topic is fundamentally flawed. The Sanders piece argues that the very language we use actively blinds us to the core problem.
I mean, language dictates perception. When we use phrases like sleeping with the boss, or they are having an affair, or they are two consenting adults, we are doing something dangerous.
How so?
Well, we are taking a massive structural organizational power imbalance and reducing it to a personal soap opera. Words like dating, relationship, and romance, they import these assumptions of equality. They make us think of mutuality, like it's just two independent people meeting in a vacuum.
It paints this picture of a rom-com where they just, happen to work in the same building.
Yeah.
We picture Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, not a manager who literally controls someone's livelihood.
Exactly. And that's why the source argues we must deliberately use the term sexual contact instead of dating.
Wow, okay. That is a very clinical shift.
It is, but it's necessary. Because when you use romantic language, it distracts from the manager's delegated authority. Organizations do not give managers titles just to inflate their egos.
Right, there is actual utility to the role.
Exactly. They delegate immense institutional power to them so they can make impartial judgments. That manager controls promotions. They control who gets the high visibility assignments.
They write the performance evaluations.
Right. So focusing on the romance completely ignores the reality that one person holds the keys to the other person's professional survival.
It makes me think of sports, honestly. Like, imagine a referee betting on a game they are currently officiating.
That is a great analogy.
Right. Now, even if that referee makes objectively fair calls the entire game, like perfect calls right down the line, the trust in the game is completely destroyed.
Yep, the fans, the players, nobody is going to believe the game was actually fair.
Because the conflict of interest was present on the field the whole time, the referee blended their delegated authority with a personal private interest.
What's fascinating here is that the trust isn't just broken for the two people involved. The neutrality of the entire system is gone.
The whole system.
An executive is trusted with confidential information and the power to allocate resources fairly. When they blend that institutional power with a personal sexual interest, they break the core trust the employer placed in them.
So even if a specific promotion is objectively deserved by that subordinate, nobody else sees it that way.
Exactly. The rest of the team will never view it as fair. The foundation of the meritocracy is instantly compromised.
When you put it like that, I mean, it's clear this is fundamentally an abuse of power. But the mechanism of how that abuse actually unfolds is what really got my attention.
It is really subtle.
Yeah, it's rarely just an overnight event where a boss walks up and demands something out of nowhere. The professional boundary doesn't just snap, it erodes.
It is almost always incremental. The analysis brings in a really crucial framework for this. It's Dr. Grant Sinnaman's seven-stage model of adult sexual grooming.
Seven stages, wow.
Yeah, the stages involve targeting, gaining trust and access, fulfilling a need, isolation, sexualization, maintaining control, and concealing.
That sounds incredibly predatory.
It is. And what makes this so insidious in a professional environment is that the early stages of grooming are perfectly camouflaged as legitimate professional development.
I want to dig into how that actually looks in an office, because gaining trust and access sounds, well, very abstract. How does the institutional power actually get weaponized in those early stages?
Well, it looks like incredible career sponsorship at first. A senior leader might offer unusual access to a junior employee.
Like taking them under their wing.
Exactly. They might invite them on a private business trip to shadow a big client meeting. Or they assign them special, high-profile overtime projects.
Okay, things that genuinely help a career.
Right. They make exclusive introductions to influential people in the industry. The manager is using the company's resources, like travel budgets, assignments, networking, to fulfill a need for that junior employee and gain their total trust.
But think about a young, ambitious employee navigating their career. You are told you need a sponsor to get ahead. You know, you need a senior leader taking an interest in you.
Which is standard career advice.
Exactly. So how do you, as an employee, tell the difference between a genuinely fantastic mentor who just wants to see you succeed and someone who is using the institution to slowly groom you?
It is all about the chronology and the really subtle migration of boundaries. Mentorship is, of course, vital. But the red flag emerges when you look at how the nature of the reliance changes.
Okay, what do you mean by the nature of reliance?
Look closely at the isolation stage of Cinnamon's model. In a workplace, isolation doesn't mean locking someone in a physical room.
Right.
It means the manager slowly positions themselves as the subordinate sole source of career oxygen. They might subtly undermine the employee's peers or other managers, saying things like, "I am the only one here who really sees your potential."
Oh, wow. And then the communication channels start to shift, right?
Precisely. Professional communications migrate from email and Slack to private WhatsApp messages. Then those messages drift into after-hours texts.
Which feels normal at first if you're working late.
Yeah. Initially, it's about a project, but then it becomes about the manager's stress or their unhappy marriage.
They start oversharing.
Exactly. The senior person creates emotional dependency under the guise of being a close mentor, isolating the employee from other support systems. They turn institutional dependence into a personal and eventually sexual opportunity.
It is like the foundation of a house slowly shifting. You don't notice the ground moving millimeter by millimeter.
You really don't.
You think you are still standing in the same professional structure. It is only months later, when the drywall suddenly cracks down the middle of the living room, that you realize the entire foundational boundary of the relationship moved a foot to the left.
Yeah, that's actually a perfect way to visualize it.
The professional support just became personal leverage.
The structure itself has fundamentally moved. And once that boundary is crossed, the immediate instinct for those involved is to try and separate the new personal relationship from the professional structure.
Which leads right into the classic defense you hear in these situations. The source tackles this head on.
Oh, the off-the-clock defense?
Yes. The manager will say, look, it happened off the clock. We met at a bar on a Saturday night. We were off duty.
Mm-hmm.
The company has no jurisdiction over what two people do on their own time in a different zip code.
And that geographic defense completely fails under legal and institutional scrutiny.
Really? It fails completely?
Entirely. The source cites a line of federal case law to dismantle this myth that the employer's jurisdiction magically evaporates the second you walk out the office door.
Okay, like what kind of cases?
Take a look at cases like Ferris, Tomka, and Parrish. In Ferris, you had an alleged assault in an overseas hotel room during a flight crew's layover. The defense was that it was a private hotel room, completely off the clock.
But the court didn't buy that it was just a random private encounter?
Not at all. The court functionally ruled that the employer arranged the travel. The employer placed those employees in that specific city together.
Oh, so the job created the situation.
Exactly. The employment itself structured the relationship and the access, so it was legally considered part of the work environment.
That makes a lot of sense.
The same logic applies to the Tomka case, which involved an after-hours business dinner, and Parrish, which centered around a funeral reception at a restaurant.
Okay, with the after-hours dinner, it is the unwritten rules of corporate life, right?
No.
Nobody is technically forcing you to go eat steaks at 8 p.m.
Right. It's not in your job description.
But every employee knows that refusing to attend an after-hours dinner with the senior partners could be career suicide.
And the courts recognize the reality of that silent pressure. The professional expectation extends far beyond 5 p.m.
Yeah.
If you are attending an event because of workplace standing, to show respect to a boss, or out of fear of professional retaliation, you are still operating within the institutional power dynamic.
It is so incredibly naive to think power just clocks out. But if they can't use the clock to defend it, they try to use the org chart.
Oh, this happens constantly.
You hear this one all the time. Sure, I am the VP of marketing, but they work in the IT department. I'm not in their direct chain of command. I don't sign their reviews, so there's no conflict.
It's a very weak defense.
Claiming the org chart protects you is like saying the CEO of a company doesn't affect your daily life just because your direct shift manager is the one who approves your timesheet. The influence is still everywhere.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, researchers Charles A. Pierce and Herman Agrinas developed a brilliant framework for this called position power.
Position power.
Yes. When someone reaches the level of a senior partner at a law firm, a police commander, or a corporate VP, they retain immense informal, apparent, and indirect power.
Because of their status.
Right. They sit in the leadership meetings. They have the ear of the other executives who actually do control the IT department.
So a casual comment in the hallway from a VP can make or break a junior employee's transfer request, regardless of actual reporting lines.
And the subordinates absolutely know this. The power is real and it's ambient. And that ambient power brings us to the concept of quid pro quo.
Right, which we usually misunderstand.
Completely. Pop culture has trained us to think quid pro quo requires a villainous monologue where the boss says, "Sleep with me or you are fired."
Like a movie villain.
Exactly. But the source references the Caribbean case to prove that quid pro quo doesn't require a single spoken ultimatum.
Because the hierarchy itself is doing the talking.
In a hierarchy, a subordinate already knows exactly who controls the rewards and the punishments. A sophisticated manager doesn't need to issue threats.
They don't have to say a word.
No. If a subordinate sees that granting personal attention to a boss is suddenly followed by better shifts, prime accounts, or special access, the organizational structure is communicating the exchange loud and clear.
Which highlights just how completely useless those HR love contracts are.
Oh, yes.
You know, the forms a company makes you sign saying, "We are in a consensual relationship and promise not to show favoritism."
They're everywhere now.
Trying to solve a massive structural conflict of authority by signing a piece of paper is absurd.
Mm.
The power to tank someone's career doesn't vanish just because you checked a box on a legal pad. The VP is still the VP.
It is just an attempt to convert a profound institutional risk into a paperwork exercise. And it fails entirely because you cannot contract away the reality of position power.
And when that professional boundary is completely erased, the fallout doesn't just stay between the two people signing that worthless piece of paper. The entire floor feels the shift.
They absolutely do.
The collateral damage is massive, isn't it?
This is where the institutional damage becomes quantifiable. There's this study from a few years back by Horan, Callen, and Carberry on what they call spillover effects.
Spillover effects.
Yeah. When a subordinate is sexually involved with a superior, the psychological contract with the rest of the team breaks. Coworkers instantly trust that subordinate less.
Because everything is suspect.
Right. They perceive unfair advantages, whether they actually exist or not. It destroys team morale almost overnight.
I mean, naturally.
Every time that employee gets a prime assignment, the rest of the team wonders, was that merit or was that pillow talk?
That brings us right back to the referee betting on the game. The perception of a fair meritocracy is completely dead. But let me play devil's advocate for a second. What if the junior employee is the one initiating it? Let's say two people just genuinely connect and fall in love.
Okay.
Isn't the company overstepping, maybe acting a bit too paternalistic, by firing them and saying they have no agency to make their own choices?
The source is highly uncompromising on this exact point. It has absolutely nothing to do with paternalism toward the subordinate or denying their agency.
It doesn't.
No. It is entirely about the accountability of the person who accepted the institutional power. Think of a clinical psychologist or a defense attorney.
Okay, standard professional rules.
Right. If a patient or a client makes a proposition, the professional must refuse. Period. The ethical boundary doesn't magically disappear just because the patient initiated it.
But because the professional holds the structural power in that dynamic.
Exactly. The employer gave the manager power, so the burden to maintain the boundary rests 100% on the manager's shoulders.
It's on them to say no.
They must keep their personal sexual interests outside of the authority they were entrusted with. And when they fail to do that, the statistics on the fallout are pretty sobering.
What are the numbers?
The source notes that 48% of workplace romances eventually dissolve, and 24% of HR professionals report sexual harassment claims arising directly from them.
And that brings us to the terror of the vertical bad breakup.
Oh, it's a nightmare.
If I date someone I met at a local coffee shop and it ends badly, I can just find a new place to get my espresso. I never have to see them again. But if I break up with my department head,
the intimacy ends, but the institutional hierarchy remains bolted in place. The person you just had a messy emotional split from still controls your daily assignments.
They still sit in on your quarterly evaluations.
Right. They might be angry, feeling rejected, or deeply embarrassed. So the subordinate is left constantly scanning for retaliation.
That sounds incredibly stressful.
It is. They fear reputational damage or suddenly being quietly boxed out of advancement opportunities. And for the employer, it is a legal and operational nightmare.
Because everything is questioned.
The company is now forced to investigate if every subsequent mediocre assignment or denied time off request was an act of post-breakup retaliation.
It paralyzes the entire department. So we have laid out the immense damage here. It destroys trust. It ruins team morale. The geographical defenses are hollow, and the breakups are a ticking legal time bomb.
Yeah, it's a mess.
This brings us to the source's ultimate conclusion for how organizations must respond to survive this reality. And it is a very hard line stance.
The employer's policy must be absolutely categorical. The source argues for strict liability for the higher ranking employee. Once the predicate facts are proven, the violation is complete.
Let's define strict liability in this context. It means no wiggle room, right?
Right.
Fact A plus fact B equals termination.
Correct. The predicate facts are simple. Sexual contact occurred and a material power differential existed between the two individuals.
And that's it?
That's it. Once a fair investigation establishes those two realities, there is no further debate. Claimed consent doesn't matter. The fact that it happened off-duty doesn't matter.
The lack of a direct reporting line doesn't matter.
None of it operates as mitigation. The discipline must be swift and certain, and termination of the senior employee must be the rule.
So what does this all mean for the reality of corporate life? Let's be brutally honest for a second.
Let's do it.
It is easy for a company to fire a mid-level manager over this. But what happens when the person on the line is a million-dollar rainmaker?
The classic problem.
Right. What if it's the top sales executive keeping the company afloat? Or a brilliant neurosurgeon bringing in endless grants? Are they really going to fire their top earner over a boundary violation?
Usually not.
A lot of companies just quietly transfer the junior employee to another department and call it a day.
This raises an important question about what an organization truly values when its back is against the wall. The source argues that reassignment or recusal is fundamentally inadequate.
Because of the ambient power we talked about.
Exactly. As we discussed with position power, informal influence survives formal org chart changes. Moving the junior employee doesn't fix the fact that the rainmaker still walks the halls with immense ambient power.
And what does it say to everyone else in the building?
That is the fatal blow. If you preserve a powerful executive who crossed this boundary just because they generate revenue, you are broadcasting to your entire workforce that your rules are actually just suggestions calibrated by rank.
Wow.
If an organization lets the rainmaker stay, they do not actually have a professional boundaries policy. They just have a hierarchy of permission.
A hierarchy of permission. That is a heavy, heavy phrase.
It really is.
If the rules only apply to the junior staff, they aren't rules. They are just weapons used to police status.
Exactly.
The senior employee voluntarily accepted a position of authority. And by doing that, they accepted that certain private behaviors are simply incompatible with holding that authority.
Yes, it's part of the job.
The core breach of trust isn't even whatever favoritism or retaliation might happen later. The breach is the senior employee's decision to willingly create that massive conflict of interest in the first place.
It comes down to protecting the structural integrity of the institution itself. You cannot have a functioning, trusted meritocracy if your employees believe, even for a second, that sexual access is a viable shortcut to professional access.
This has been an incredible reframing of the dynamic we see depicted in pop culture and the workplace all the time.
It really changes how you look at things.
Let's summarize the journey we've just been on. We have learned that sleeping with the boss is a dangerous misnomer that tricks us into treating serious abuses of institutional power, like simple tabloid gossip.
But we have to move past the gossip.
We unpacked how grooming happens right in the open through the weaponization of company resources and the isolation of ambition. We debunked the myths that power stops at 5 p.m. or stays neatly inside the lines of an org chart.
Because power is everywhere.
Maintaining professional boundaries isn't just about avoiding HR complaints. It is absolutely vital because it is the only way to protect institutional trust, preserve a true meritocracy, and prevent the weaponization of delegated power.
The employer gave the manager authority over professional lives, not sexual access to them.
And holding that line is the only way an organization survives in the long term.
I couldn't agree more.
I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder as we wrap up this deep dive. We have talked a lot about the physical workplace today. You know, after-hours dinners at steakhouses, hotel layovers, corner offices.
The traditional office stuff.
Right. But if you are working remotely right now, think about this. For millions of us, the physical office barely exists anymore. Our professional lives live entirely inside our personal smartphones, via texts, Zoom calls, and direct messages, sitting right there on the home screen next to our most intimate personal lives.
The lines are completely blurred.
In a world where your boss is literally in your pocket 24/7, where the physical separation between work and home has completely dissolved, are the boundaries of institutional power becoming even more invisible? And because they are invisible, are they becoming even more dangerous to cross?
It is a critical challenge that modern organizations have barely begun to solve.
Next time you hear a rumor at the water cooler or in a Slack channel, I hope you will look at your own workplace architecture with a newly sharpened perspective. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the structures around you, and we'll see you next time.